This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Wednesday, May 12th. I'm Shannon Young. Thank you for joining me here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, Boulder is moving ahead with revisions to the city code that would prevent homeless people from camping in urban parks. More coming up in a report from last night's Boulder City Council meeting. Boulder Health Science entrepreneur Larry Gold says that Operation Warp Speed was not the key to creating vaccines against what he calls the terrifying COVID virus. We'll find out more up ahead. Then, two regular Wednesday morning features, Make Them Hear You with Chris Moore, and Naturally with local herbalist Brigitte Mars. A BBC update and commentary from Jim Hightower at the bottom of the hour, and then it's a public affair. At 8:35, Rosana Longo brings us voices from a vaccine equity clinic that's trying to make the vaccination process easier. Then at 9, a pollinator paradise in the middle of Boulder. We'll hear about one woman's effort to help bees and other insects thrive in the Goss Grove neighborhood by creating a pollinator corridor. It's all still ahead this morning after these headlines from Jamie Sudler.
Boulder County and most of the other Metro Denver counties will lift the remaining COVID-19 public health restrictions this weekend, although people will still be required to wear masks in specific indoor settings as a statewide order remains in place, at least until next month. The state still requires masks in schools, child care centers, indoor children's camps, prisons, and health care settings. However, masks are no longer required in indoor gatherings where at least 80% of the group is inoculated against the coronavirus. In addition to Boulder, Jefferson, Adams, Arapahoe, and Broomfield counties confirmed to the Denver Post they will move from level blue to a new phase called level clear on Sunday. Once the metro counties make that move, restaurants, bars, offices, and other indoor settings can operate at 100% capacity with no additional requirements. The counties moving to level clear on Sunday will enter an observation period for 90 days. If a county experiences a rise in its rate of coronavirus hospital admissions, it will move to stricter requirements. The city of Denver's public health agency stopped short of committing to the move to level clear, but said the city anticipates aligning with neighboring counties. The Aurora Public School System will require its staff to be vaccinated against the coronavirus for the next school year. Superintendent Rico Munn made the announcement in a letter to employees and added that some exceptions will be allowed under state and federal law. Meanwhile, Republicans at the state legislature are pushing a measure that would ban employers from mandating COVID-19 vaccines for their workers and customers. The bill is scheduled for its first hearing today. However, the Denver Post reports it faces an uphill battle with Democrats in control of both chambers of the General Assembly and also the governor's office. Colorado's major universities will require vaccines for students and faculty in the fall, and some businesses are making patrons show proof of vaccination for indoor dining. A final decision on whether to offer Colorado kids between the ages of 12 and 15 COVID-19 vaccinations is expected today following a meeting by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Speaking to the Boulder City Council last night, Lexi Nolan, acting director of the county's public health department, said if the CDC moves forward, kids in the 12 to 15 category would receive the Pfizer vaccine. Previously, only those 16 and older were eligible for the two-dose vaccine. Boulder County's positivity rate for COVID-19 continues to decline, but Nolan noted it's not uniform across the state.
Our positivity rate is at 3.1%, which is down from about 5% from a month ago. There are still a few counties across Colorado that are still in red, in what used to be the red level on the dial, which is greater than 10% positivity. Colorado has been, over the past few weeks, experiencing a case surge that put us among the second highest among U.S. states after Michigan in terms of case rates. So we are coming down off of that spike and declining quickly, but we still have some work to do looking across the state.
Nolan reported 21 new cases of COVID in Boulder County as of yesterday and said local hospitalizations are flat with no new deaths, which stand at 255. Right now, the statewide indoor mask order remains in place through June 2nd. We'll have more on the Boulder City Council meeting coming up. Yesterday, Boulder County Public Health appointed the first Latina to head the department as its new executive director. Camille Rodriguez will assume the position early next month. There were more than 60 applicants for the position and two finalists, according to the Daily Camera. Most recently, Rodriguez served as a county administrator and a local health department director in Illinois. More than $100 million is coming as emergency funding for colleges and students in the state's 2nd Congressional District. Congressman Joe Neguse, Democrat from Lafayette, made the announcement in a release yesterday. The funding will help institutions cope with the financial fallout from the pandemic and allow them to serve students safely. At least half of the funding each institution receives will be distributed in the form of emergency cash grants to students who are facing hunger, homelessness, and other hardship. CU Boulder will receive more than $51 million under the American Rescue Plan, with over $25 million set aside for financial aid for students. A group of environmental advocates and health care workers have filed a lawsuit against Boulder over the connection to the Rocky Mountain Greenway. The city council decided in April that it would move forward with its plan to participate in a grant to fund an underpass at Colorado 128. The suit alleges that the city should have considered other alternatives and held a public hearing before it agreed to move forward with plans to fund trail connections into the Rocky Flats Refuge, site of the former nuclear weapons production facility. The complaint filed by Physicians for Social Responsibility Colorado, the Environmental Information Network, and biologist Harvey Nichols names the city of Boulder and Boulder council members as defendants. Attorney Randall Weiner said the goal of the suit would be to have Boulder develop a connection to the Rocky Mountain Greenway that altogether avoids Rocky Flats. The National Weather Service forecasts sunny skies today and a high in the upper 50s to low 60s with a slight chance of showers later this afternoon. Tomorrow, sunny with highs in the low 70s. Right now, it's 43 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
Boulder City Council heard plenty of good news last night regarding the city's response to homelessness in the past year, but also asked that ordinances be prepared to crack down on the unhoused who occupy city parks. KGNU's Roz Brown has more.
It's been hard to miss the increased number of homeless encampments across Boulder since the pandemic began, and a majority of city council members think the number could be reduced by adding new laws to the city code. During a study session last night, the city attorney was directed to draft ordinances to prohibit tents from being pitched in urban parks and ban propane tanks, both characterized as a public safety risk. Boulder Police Chief Maris Harrell told council she supports the measures.
I do think that it will add an investigative point and also enforcement while we're trying to address these encampment issues with the city. So I do think both changes to the Boulder Municipal Code would be beneficial for both our investigation and our enforcement of the encampments.
And while most council members are on board with the new ordinances, some, like Adam Swetlick, are not at all sure they'll accomplish the goal of reducing homelessness within the city limits.
Yeah, this is another one of those interesting situations where it's like an ideal world law versus a world that we live in law, where obviously it would be a bad idea for, in an ideal world, for people to stack propane tanks and to erect enclosed tents and have activities during the day that aren't prohibited that you can't see. But that's not the world we live in, I guess. And until we can solve that issue, this is just adding more enforcement to a mostly unenforceable situation. So we can move forward with it. That's fine. But I don't think it solves anything, ultimately.
Council members Swetlick, Aaron Brockett, and Rachel Friend have unsuccessfully lobbied fellow council members to consider sanctioned encampments, much like those being tried in Denver. Friend said she would not renew that discussion last night, but expressed reservations about the new ordinances.
My understanding is one tank is often used for warmth. And so I would be very hesitant to dip below the one tank because we already worry about people freezing. So within the bounds of safety, we also want people to have access to warmth. So, and then on the tents, I agree that our parks are for parks and yet people have to have a place to be. It's hard for me to say, yes, let's move forward with a harsher penalty or making it more clear that you cannot have a tent in a park when We don't have anywhere else that you can have a tent. So I'm comfortable moving forward on the propane tank with some, I guess, safety exception for one tank if people need it for warmth, but not comfortable at this point when we're not moving forward with where you can go to say, you know, you still can't be here.
A report released in March found nationwide that homelessness increased 2.4% in 2020 compared to 2019 and included nearly 10,000 Coloradans who were unhoused. In Boulder County, homelessness also tracked upward for the third straight year, with the pandemic blamed for much of the increase. At the same time, by embracing a housing first policy to address homelessness, city staff says in the past 2 years, the number of people spending nights at the homeless shelter has been cut in half. In addition, the number of long-term shelter residents is decreasing over time as more people are housed. Housing and Human Services Director Kurt Fernhaber also reported that Boulder County has had low rates of COVID among the unhoused compared to other communities. Councilman Mark Wallach wanted to know why.
Our statistics in terms of the positivity rate of 8% on COVID for our homeless population is substantially better than that for Denver. Is there any particular factor that we can attribute that to?
A couple things that we've looked at. First of all, the COVID Recovery Center started very early in the pandemic on March 20th. So because we started early, we were able to prevent the spread of COVID.
The Boulder County COVID Recovery Center is scheduled to end operations next month. Meanwhile, City Council will vote on the tent and propane tank bans at a future meeting. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
COVID concerns led Boulder entrepreneur Larry Gold to cancel last year's Gold Lab Symposium about the science of health. This Thursday and Friday, the Gold Lab Symposium is back, but as a virtual Zoom event. Larry Gold spoke about this with KGNU in an interview inside his home office without anyone wearing masks. That's even though, at the age of almost 80, Gold has a high risk of dying if he becomes infected with COVID-19. Gold didn't wear a mask because he and his interviewer are both vaccinated, and he says that's no thanks to Operation Warp Speed. Gold says there's a more important effort that was going on behind the scenes that allowed the U.S. to develop COVID vaccines. For more, here's KGNU's Shelley Schlender.
I spent more than a year in this room, in this house.
You're talking about the home you live in?
Yeah.
In your office?
Yes. I worked from home 95% of the time.
A lot of your labs at CU Boulder did stay open. Part of that is because there was so much science and technology that gave people ways to be tested. The ventilation systems were extremely well planned.
Lab work went on as it should have. Those people were vaccinated early when the vaccines were available. People worked at a distance. We did that at SomaLogic. The University of Colorado did that. I believe the number of infected people that resulted from this activity was very, very small. Even before the people were vaccinated, face masks and distancing, or the bulk of it, were adequate in this setting of healthcare research.
How old are you?
I'm unfortunately a few months short of 80.
If you're almost 80, you're in the high-risk zone for COVID. Statistically, you would have a lot of risk if you got it. You and I are both vaccinated. We're doing this interview face-to-face. We're not wearing masks.
And I think that's legitimate. There's some distance. We're not sitting on each other's lap, after all. And I read in the last year thousands of papers about this virus. I used to be a virologist. I found it easy to keep up because it's right where I knew stuff. It's a terrifying virus. It is not the flu, obviously. We've learned that. Worldwide, I believe, worldwide, the number of deaths is about 2% the people who have been infected.
But Larry Gold, you just called it a terrifying virus. It's not an Ebola. It's more like the common cold. You're calling it terrifying?
I think it's terrifying. The unknowns about this virus RA, how effective the vaccines will be long term. We know they're great now, 95% or so. And 95% is an unbelievably wonderful number. It's not the same as smallpox, which is nearly complete, but it's a fantastic number. And it reflects, by the way, just even though you didn't ask me, not Operation Warp Speed, but the fact for 20 years, the scientific community all around the world, including the United States and including Singapore and including everywhere that SARS-1 was a problem.
SARS-1 was a virus that affected Asian countries.
Toronto was a big center of it also.
It was a coronavirus, mm-hmm. And it was, what, 10 years ago?
I think longer. I think of the work on this class of viruses as a model for what basic science is all about. The virus risk petered out.
SARS.
SARS. Yes.
A decade
SARS
or so ago.
Well, I think it was two. It's okay. It was a long time ago. The research continued, in part stimulated by the warnings of Bill Gates, who I considered an extraordinary visionary. I mean, it's hard to be a visionary about something that's so terrifying. The first virus ended, but the research continued. Because of that basic research, we knew for this virus what was the likely best protein to use as a vaccine, which was the spike protein. We knew all of that going in. Moderna and Pfizer were ready with their RNA-based vaccines, which is all about the spike protein. And so we got lucky. If this had been a brand new virus like HIV was when it happened, we would not be in a nearly as good a place as we are now.
How come you call it terrifying, though?
Well, because the long-term effects on people are still being sorted out, and there are lots. There are cardiovascular risks. There are scarrings in your lungs. It's not like after a week and the flu is gone, you're fine. This virus has long-term consequences that are still being studied.
And yet, for the vast majority of people, there doesn't seem to be any effect at all and any lasting effect, except for the fact that they're more immune to it, at least for 3 months.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you. I think when things like pathogens are poorly understood, it's a good idea to keep studying them and not to get smug.
And that was Larry Gold. He's the creator of the Gold Lab Symposium on the Science of Health. Out of concern for COVID, that symposium is happening virtually this Thursday and Friday. Sign up is available online at goldlabfoundation.org. For KGNU, I'm Shelley Schlender.
Time now for Make Them Hear You with Chris Marr.
Make Them Hear You.
This is Make Them Hear You with ideas how you can have your voice heard before Congress. In 1976, 3 years after the historic Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision legalizing abortion, the Hyde Amendment passed overwhelmingly in Congress and was considered a compromise between pro-life and pro-choice factions. It bans Medicaid funding for abortion except in cases of rape, incest, and life endangerment. The Hyde Amendment has been incorporated into a range of other federal programs, including the military's TRICARE program, federal prisons, the Peace Corps, and federal employees' health benefits program. 48% of all lower-income women were enrolled in Medicaid in 2016. When policymakers placed restrictions on Medicaid coverage of abortion, it forces 1 in 4 poor women seeking abortion to carry an unwanted pregnancy to term. Now, as a senator, Joe Biden was a longtime supporter of the Hyde Amendment and cited his Catholic faith as one reason he backed it. As recently as the summer of 2019, the Biden campaign said he supported the ban, and the Hyde Amendment remains very popular among Americans, so repealing it would make it harder for Democrats to win in swing districts. In most recent polls, a majority of Americans oppose public funding of abortions. Respondents support, quote, banning federal funding for abortions, except in cases of rape or disabled woman's life, and, quote, government health insurance programs for low-income women like Medicaid should not cover abortion. The average gap between pro-funding and anti-funding positions is 19 points. Even among Democrats, only a narrow margin of Democrats support federal abortion funding. In surveys, women are no more likely than men to support that policy. Since over 40% of Americans identify as pro-life, many Americans on both sides feel it is unfair for so many people to be forced to pay taxes to support something they consider immoral. The sexes differ on other reproductive policy questions, but not on abortion funding. Support for federal funding of birth control, including 75% of Republicans, is at 83%. Progressives like Bernie Sanders strongly oppose the Hyde Amendment because it strongly impacts the poor, women on Medicaid, and others. Those denied an abortion have four times greater odds of living below the federal poverty level. They're more likely to stay in abusive relationships and to experience serious complications from the end of pregnancy. Because of social and economic inequality linked to racism and discrimination, women of color are disproportionately likely to be insured through Medicaid. Opponents of the Hyde Amendment feel they still need to educate more moderate folks in Congress and more moderate members of the voting public, but the EACH bill to eliminate the Hyde Amendment is up for vote in the Senate right now. If you have thoughts on the EACH Act, you can contact your senators. This is Chris Moore with Make Them Hear You.
Now, let's join Brigitte Mars for advice about holistic living on this week's Naturally.
Good morning. Welcome to Naturally. Do you like being woken up to leaf blowers and lawnmowers and weed whackers? You know, we really need to rethink this. We know what the solutions are, and I'm really encouraging us to think about creating edible lawns. Do you know that we are using a third of our nation's water to water non-native grasses? Well, that's a lot of water. And with that water, we could be growing food. Yes, it's so true. But instead, we've been bamboozled and thinking, oh, I got to get in my car. I got to go drive to the store and buy some food from another continent. So I realize, you know, grass is kind of nice to picnic on and throw the frisbee around and all that. So what are some possible solutions? Well, we could grow things that do provide pollination for the bees, like white clover, Trifolium repens, as a white clover that grows really low and still produces flowers. We could grow violets or thyme. You can check in with local companies about what would be some edible, low-maintenance lawns. And you know, there was actually a study done that showed an 80-year-old woman with a broom could clear as many leaves as a leaf blower. Okay, so, you know, all those things use gasoline too. So we also should be thinking about, you know, our pollinators, which pollinate the food for us. We could grow flowers that the bees love, like lemon balm and hyssop and all the mints. We could save time by staying home more and growing local food. It would just be a wonderful thing. My friend Etef likes to say, let us turn up the beat. There are so many things that would grow easily with less water than we're using to grow the grass. And maybe you just have a balcony or a patio, but that's a start. When we grow green things, it provides oxygen so that we can breathe better in our polluted cities. You know, we know the solutions. It's time to be part of it. And I realize that many of us, myself included, live in HOAs. We need to get together with our neighbors, build community, do petitions, and say we would rather have a community garden and edible lawns rather than warning pesticides applied. Hey, it's time, people. It's been time for a long time, and I really applaud all of you that are doing something. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Wake up, America, and smell the roses. Hey, and by the way, dandelions are the first food for the bees in the springtime.
If you'd like to learn more about bee-friendly lawns, check out today's A Public Affair at the 9 o'clock hour, which explores one woman's effort to help pollinators thrive in the Goss Grove neighborhood. And that does it for today's Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Shannon Young.